Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
I'm Ben. You are new. We are, as always, joined by our super producer, Noel Brown. And often on this show, Scott, we talk about digging deeper into a topic.
Oh, very clever, Ben. Very clever segue. Sometimes they're not quite as smooth a lot of the time,
right.
but you make note of that. You usually say, as a way of an excellent segue, and then you go into something completely non sequitur, but
it's true.
That one actually worked. That was pretty good.
Thanks, man.
And this is something that I think we've talked about this in the past, but only, it's just a very brief mention.
Just in passing.
Yeah, really. I mean, we got a listener suggestion not long ago from a listener named Sean F. And Sean wrote in, it was in June of 2016, so very recent, for us anyways, and said, usually we wait like a year before we actually fulfill any of these requests, but here we are.
We have a wide margin of error when it comes to time.
I feel like I have to come clean every time I say that. Like, that's fast for us. It's really fast. Okay, so anyway, Sean writes in and says, "Hi guys, I've recently discovered the podcast and I can't get enough of it." Well, thank you, Sean.
Thanks,
that's a nice compliment. I didn't see this in the list of topics, so I was wondering if you guys ever did a show about the Ferrari Dino that was found buried in a yard in Los Angeles in 1978. I came across the story a while back, and it's pretty fascinating. Thanks a lot, Sean. And, Sean, I think that I kind of just mentioned this in passing, but I think we did give this a quick mention at least in one other podcast, maybe in a couple of other podcasts.
Right. We have earlier shows on amazing barn finds and cars that were lost and recovered.
Yeah. Also, there's the and I have a feeling we mentioned it in the Miss Belvedere story. Remember the buried Plymouth Belvedere story from, it was back in November 2014, where they did kind of a time capsule thing with a car in Tulsa, Oklahoma that didn't turn out so well. That was a two-part episode, and I have a feeling we mentioned it in there, but if not there, I'm pretty darn sure that we mentioned it in the case of Sandra West and the Ferrari coffin. Now, that was one that happened right around the same time as this story, so that's going to intertwine with this tale that we're about to spin today or about to tell today. And we did that episode back in March of 2013. And that was a young widow, a socialite. Mm-hmm. She was like 37 years old.
Yeah.
An oil heiress, I believe. And she died of a drug overdose and wanted to be buried in a Ferrari California or something? It was like a special edition Ferrari, a blue one. Mm-hmm. And it made worldwide news, really. But that was back in 1977. What we're about to talk about today really came to light in about 1978, and it's something that Jalopnik has dug into. Actually, they're the ones who really cracked this whole thing wide open
because they cracked the case.
It was out of the news for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. One of the best ways to start this story would be to cast our memory back to the 70s.
Yeah.
Before we do that, we do want to say that while some of the information we're exploring today may have been in those earlier podcasts, the only reason we know the dates of those podcasts are because we had them written down. Those were our wild days, you guys. Scott and I were like the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, we were covering a little bit of everything, kind of playing it fast and loose, you know, with the topics. So, it's kind of a grab bag of stuff from back then, right? But this story, you know, one quick thing before we even really start here, I think we better give a little bit more credit to Jalopnik for what they've done here, because there was some major investigative work that went on behind the scenes to make this whole thing happen. And they wrote a couple of pretty good articles, and I'll tell you how this kind of comes about, at least online anyways. Most everybody probably, if you follow Jalopnik and, you know, the blogs and everything, you probably read this back when it was first written about in 2012, around January.
Mm-hmm.
The title was "The True Story of How a Ferrari Ended Up Buried in Someone's Yard." And then just a few months later, in August of the same year, of 2012, right?
Yeah.
They wrote another article that says, "We solved the mystery of how a Ferrari ended up buried in someone's yard." So there was a lot of digging that went on after that. And that's all because of some phone calls that happened. There were some really interesting things that went on, and they even included there's a video online, a YouTube video that I recommend you watch after you listen to this podcast. It was on Jalopnik on Drive, and it's just really the tale of how this all happened. It's an easy, you know, keyword search, and you'll find it, the buried Ferrari Dino or something like that. You'll find it very, very interesting. You get to see all the players involved and really how all this worked out, and you get to see the Ferrari itself and some of the photographs and things, which we can't do here on this podcast, which I wish we could, but
right.
You get to see some of the, I don't know, the work of the, I'll call them the resurrection men that brought this thing back. And
that's great.
Yeah, and, you know, like the restoration work and the mechanics and all that. But, man, what an interesting story. And, again, it starts really in 1974 with the purchase of a Ferrari Dino out in the L.A. area.
Right, a Dino 246 GTS specifically.
And it was picked up by a plumber as a gift for his wife. And we'll get to that in just a moment here. But
that's a heck of a gift, too.
It really is. So here's the story that goes along with this. And I'll correct some of this as we go, and you'll understand when we get to, like, the second part, right? So in February of 1978, a Ferrari Dino 246 GTS, as you said, Ben, was found in the backyard of an L.A. County home. Now, as I mentioned just at the head of this podcast, mm-hmm. this is only about 1 year after the Sandra West burial in 1977. That happened in May of 1977. So
right.
This really got a lot of attention because that, of course, was in the news. Now they found a buried Ferrari Dino in the backyard of someone in L.A.
Inexplicably.
Yeah,
too.
So it's like, what's with all the people burying Ferraris, you know, all over the place? This is really weird. So the story was, there's a story that we heard from the LA Times, was that a couple of kids that were just kind of digging around in the backyard, they found what they thought to be the roof of a car. They scratched something, they found mm-hmm. it, they kind of dug it up a little bit, found yeah. that it was more substantial than just a piece of metal that was there. It was something big, and it was green metallic. They didn't know what it was, mm-hmm. but they flagged down a passing sheriff's cruiser car, and the guy came back to investigate and decided that, yeah, there's something here that's worth looking at. I'm going to come back with some detectives, and we'll see what's up.
Right. This was at 1137 West 119th Street in the West Athens section of L.A. So they got a team of guys together. They rounded up a posse of, as Scott calls them, resurrection men. This was the first wave, I guess, the ones who actually dug it up.
Yeah.
They had shovels. The detectives who came were Joe Sabas and Lenny Carroll, and they also had a skip loader with them. And you can read the L.A. Times article that you're mentioning earlier, Scott, wherein the journalist initially describes the car as in surprisingly good condition.
Yeah, exactly right. And the estimated value, they said, was right around $18,000 in 1978. Now, if you extrapolate that to 2016, mm-hmm. that's something like $66,300. So it's a lot of money. I did the inflation calculator. I would be willing to bet that it's probably worth more than that at this point. Not just mm-hmm. it's not just a straight calculation. There's also the appreciation for, you know, the type of vehicle it is, the limited number that are left,
right.
et cetera. You know, special editions, all that stuff. Because this was a special edition car, we find out. It had the flares and chairs option, which is a factory option.
Mm-hmm.
And the flares and chairs option, which is kind of a strange thing to call this, I guess, included fender flares and special factory wheels and also Daytona seats that you would have had to have ordered a Daytona model to get. But this was an upgrade as part of just this one package, and very few of those were made. So a lot of unique items on this vehicle that make it very distinguishable.
They also found the serial number and the license plate was still attached. And this was key to their investigation, because when they found the license plate, they were able to track it to a purchase in October of 1974 by a fellow named Rosendo Cruz
yeah.
of Alhambra.
Now, that's the L.A. plumber that I told you about, mm-hmm. who purchased this as a gift, a birthday gift, I believe, for his wife. And
this is so bad.
This is really, really dirty. Okay, so he purchases this for his wife in October of that year, right? They drive it about, was it 501 miles or something like that? That was on the odometer.
Uh-huh.
In December, on December 7th of that very year of 1974, Cruz makes arrangements to have this thing stolen while they're at dinner. They're going to go to the Brown Derby, going to have you know, some martinis and dinner or whatever, and he arranges to have this thing stolen. He's got a whole backstory for it. So just 3 months later, again, he's like trying to pull an insurance scam. So, you know, it's like buying the big gift and then getting all the money back for the gift. And I think the initial purchase price was something like $22,000 or something like that. It's a little bit more than that, maybe. But the thing is, like, so here's the question, though. How did the car end up in this backyard of this L.A. home? Because mm-hmm. if the plan was to steal it, the initial plan probably would have been to, you know, chop it up, you know, get rid of the all identifying plates and, you know, serial numbers, things like that. But none of that had happened to this car. The most that they had done was they had torched out the I guess the logo on the back, you know, the where it said Dino GT or GTS or something like that. There's a script tag on the back that they cut out with a torch, but that was it. They left the license plates in place. They left the identification number.
They didn't scratch the VIN.
Yeah, the VIN was there. What a strange thing, huh? So there's something else up with this, and not only that. How did it end up underground? I mean, you think it'd be like stashed away in a garage somewhere or something, or, you know, well hidden.
Get this, folks. Of course, the detectives ask the tenants of the house and the neighbors of that house if they noticed anything unusual back in 1974. The tenants were no help. They said, hey, look, officers, we've only been here for 3 months. Mm-hmm. And the neighbors said, I don't remember anything odd happening back in 1974, but that's a tricky thing with memory that happens in the course of investigations. I mean, very few people will actually be able to recall what happened, you know, this time last year.
Yeah, well, I wonder, because, I mean, someone's burying a Ferrari in their backyard. That's a little different than maybe, you know, somebody who, I think they maybe... we're out there chopping wood on that day in December of 1974.
That's true. That's true.
You know, I'm not sure exactly what happened there, but that's a huge thing to see happening. And it seems like it would take longer than, an hour or two.
Right.
It seems like it's a huge project. Now, I don't think it was an empty pool or anything like that. It wasn't like something where it was going to be filled in anyways, and the neighbors just kind of expected that to happen. I think it was just a hole.
And the detectives didn't buy the neighbor's story either. They thought that was weird.
Like maybe they were covering something up, or they just didn't want to snitch or something. Maybe that was the deal.
But
the thing is, the question is, like, whoever buried it, they found certain things that were a little bit inconsistent with the story that was being, or the story that had played out in their head, you know, that this was going to be an insurance scam or whatever, but because they had placed rugs over the top of it, they had plastic sheeting inside, they had stuffed towels into the vents to keep the worms from crawling in.
Mm-hmm.
They had covered certain key areas of the vehicle to try to maybe preserve it a bit while it was underground. I know that's a funny thing to think of, but, you know, because it's just being buried with dirt. It's not encased in anything. It's not in a shell of any kind. This was just simply buried. They just put dirt all around it, and there were other problems later that we'll tell you about. It was really stupid. Stupid thieves. That's always the case, isn't it? Okay, so they didn't have any kind of leads at all at this time. And actually what had happened, I guess, was they decided that years before, you know, in 1974, so this is, you know, 4 years later, they're finding the car in 1978. In 1974, the insurance company, which is Farmers Insurance Group, had decided that it was what they called a righteous theft. You know, that something had just simply happened. You know, they mm-hmm. they got the story from the original owner. There was no way to track or find out where the vehicle had gone. They investigated but couldn't find the vehicle, and they paid off the loss of $22,500 to the Dino's legal owner, which was at the time the Hollywood branch of the Bank of America. So I guess the current owner, or the owner at that point then, once they cut that check, would be the Farmers Insurance Group.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah,
so they have the car, right? And
they want to recoup their loss.
Well, yeah, that's right. And of course, you know, the story, of course, is, as we said, it's drawing press because of the recent Sandra West burial story, but that kind of fizzled out again. But there was some kind of like play back and forth between the two stories and, you know, like, what's with all the buried Ferraris, that kind of thing. And a lot of jokes and things that were going on with, you know, like, I'm interested in that Ferrari you dug up, and then they'll say, like, oh, I'll see what I can dig up on the thing.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like, it'll have, you know, tongue-in-cheek type stuff that's mm-hmm. happening. So, but there are a lot of requests for information about this thing because a lot of people wanted to buy it, you know, sight unseen. They just heard that there's a Ferrari Dino that was, you know, unearthed and could be worth something, could not be. You know, they didn't know the condition or anything like that. But there's more to tell about that story anyways.
Right. We also see some great investigative work by other journalists, a guy named Greg Sharp writing for Auto Week.
Yeah, and that happens a lot
much later.
In 1986, someone from Auto Week, you said Greg Sharp was writing, wrote something about the Dino and mentioned some stuff about, like, its pre-burial life, you know, like mm-hmm. what had happened to it before. And he told the whole thing about, you know, where it went to. There were 10 vehicles that were sold to a certain dealership in the San Francisco Bay Area, and, you know, how it had been sold, I guess, and who it went to and what had happened. But it was still left with kind of a mystery, right? They knew that, you know, it had been sold for $22,500 to this plumber as a birthday present for his wife. And then they drove it 501 miles. And then the story of the, you know, the I guess the theft, you know, the evening of the theft and what had happened. And the story that the guy gave you, we didn't really say this at all, but the story was that he was going, and he had this well planned out, you know, this plumber, Cruz did. He said that he was going to drive up to the Brown Derby, on Wilshire Boulevard, and then he was going to hand the keys off to the valet, but then he got a, he said he was going to say that he saw a gleam in the eye of the valets as he was handing the key over, and he decided against handing the keys to these guys because he didn't know what would happen to it. So he parked it out on Wilshire Boulevard on his own. He just self-parked.
Right.
And then when he came out from dinner, lo and behold, the car is gone.
Poof.
Yeah. So that's what happened. So then he didn't have to have anybody, you know, he didn't have to frame anybody, I guess, you know, any of the valets, I guess, for taking it. And it seems like it worked out okay, I guess, because he ended up, well, sort of okay. He ended up, you know, with his check, you know, paying off the debt.
For his righteous theft.
Yeah, for the righteous theft, I guess. And the thieves, whoever they were, got away scot-free.
And Sharp is also the person who gives a more realistic look at the state of the Barry Dino, because surprisingly good condition for a Barry car does not in any way mean drivable or safe. If we can just take a closer look at some of the damage of this car. So it had 21 layers of paint. They had white pox on them. There was rust throughout the body, and it had spread almost everywhere. And it was in, there was also rot inside the leather interior. So get this, Scott, speaking of goons, these thieves stuffed towels in the windows. Smart.
Yeah, in the vents, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
In the windows, vents, any area where something go in.
Sure.
But that only works if you remember to roll the windows all the way up.
Oh, boy. So they left the windows down, so the interior was completely open to the, well, I guess an underground burial area, you know, like all the moisture, all the dirt, all the insects, everything else would get in there. Man, what a mess. These, like I said earlier, I was alluding to this earlier, just stupid thieves. And this was discovered by a guy named Tom Underwood, I believe, right? Was that his name? Hang on a second. I'm searching my notes.
Yeah.
But Tom, he was a an insurance investigator, right? Because he was interested. He thought, well, you know, it's reported as being in this condition, but I'm going to go really check this thing out and see what kind of condition it is in. So, as you said, not in good shape. And there's not only that, but, you know, the engine, of course, the exhaust were completely plugged solid with mud. Also, you know, just hauling it out of there with a chain with this, what they call it, a skid loader or something, a skip loader.
Skip loader, yeah.
Hauling it out with the chain had done a lot of body damage to the thing as well. There were scratch marks and gouges and, you know, the windshield was smashed. There's just all kinds of problems. So it was really in poor, poor condition. And Tom Underwood's assessment that unless this car was shipped back to the factory, this thing was never going to see the road ever again. It was really unrestorable. There's just no way to do it. It was beyond repair.
Because there's a little bit of archaeological recovery that goes into this kind of thing when you're exhuming or disinterring any sophisticated mechanical device. You have to be very careful because the odds are that you could destroy it trying to retrieve it.
Yeah.
And this poor Dino, man, it took some damage just on the way out as well.
Well, sure, yeah. And so with this report in hand, you know, this Tom Underwood report in hand, Farmers Insurance had a plan because they had so many calls to purchase the car, and they thought that, you know, this is going to be a big PR crisis for us. We're going to have a lot of issues if we, you know, it's what we said initially, or the initial reports were, that it's in good shape, and a lot of people are offering a lot of money. So they thought, well, we need to put this on public display so people can get an idea of what they're buying, because they might lower their bids a bit. You know, we don't want to gouge anybody for something, you know, and then end up being the bad guy. So Underwood has an idea. He puts the car on public display, and they take it to a warehouse, a private warehouse in Pasadena, and it stays there for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. But the problem was anybody that was invited to view it, who could, you know, then submit a sealed bid, apparently was allowed to really look this thing over, and they took just about everything off the vehicle that was, you know, loose.
That wasn't bolted down.
Yeah.
Including the dipstick.
Yeah. So this is a lot like sometimes the cars at auto shows suffer this as well.
Right.
People will steal shift knobs. They'll steal cigarette lighters, you know, covers to any kind of area. You know, it's the craziest stuff comes missing on auto show cars.
Hood ornaments.
It's the same way. So they're there looking at this this car that's to be auctioned off, and they're stealing all the stuff from it. So when they get it back, it's in worse condition than ever. I mean, it's missing now a bunch of pieces. You know, pieces that they can easily, you know, put in their pocket and carry away, I guess. Nothing huge, really. Anyways, it comes back worse than ever before, and eventually they get it down to the point where there's a high bid that's reached between somewhere between $5,000 and $9,000. They didn't really say. And then it was made, it was made the property of a very young mechanic who had his own garage out in Burbank, California.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, in San Fernando Valley on Burbank Boulevard. And, I guess he apparently got the thing to start finally.
Oh,
and
yeah,
mechanic,
yeah.
He must have been a talented mechanic. We'll learn yeah. more about this guy later,
yeah, yeah.
but he's a talented mechanic. But they do say that in this story, they got it to start, and that's the end of the story. No one really knows much more about it than that because the Dino at this point of this story, you know, in February of 2012? At that point in the story, no one really knew where this thing ended up because it was unlisted on any kind of Dino registry and no one had really heard about it. You know, no one had really bothered to investigate what happened to it, even though they knew it had some vanity plates that were pretty unusual.
Yes, the vanity plates read dug up.
Yeah, you would think you would put that together, right? Here's a metallic
right.
green Ferrari Dino with a license plate dug up in
right.
that area because it never left the area.
Yeah.
You think somebody would have put that together, but no one did.
It's got a custom package on it, too.
No.
And, well, here's the thing to put the capstone on this story. So this talented mechanic does a labor of love, puts in a new alternator, distributor, and that's when he gets it to start. And then what happens? The cylinder rings stick. So as of that time in 2012, the story is over.
Yeah, that's it. So it disappears because I think the guy also closed up his shop and moved somewhere else as well. So, it's an intriguing story, of course, you know, because the car disappears and we love stories like that, you know, where it's out there somewhere, but no one knows where. And here's a restored Dino, you know, because it has been restored, at least somewhat as far as we know, right? And that was it. But they dug a little bit deeper then. They,
yes.
Jalopnik. So Mike Spinelli, the guy that wrote this article, he was, I think, the editor-in-chief at the time of
and
Jalopnik.
And by the way, great work, Mike, if you're listening.
Yeah, very good work on this because he dug around, made some phone calls, and there were some, incorrect names in original articles, things like that. He really pieced together quite a bit here. Mm-hmm. Pretty impressive. But he also did get a phone call from one of the investigators on the case, I believe. He spoke with the Dino's current owner and also one of the investigators on the case, one of the original guys from the case.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy, as he said, you know, I was there. I was the one who went down to the hole and made sure that there were no corpses or no contraband in the car.
Right.
Because that was one of the initial fears was that this was probably someone trying to hide a body.
Right, which reminds me of one of my favorite yet darker podcasts that we covered, which was about all the cars that are found when water recedes
yeah.
in lakes across the U.S.
Yeah, wasn't there? There was something in the Houston area recently. They were finding via sonar, I believe it was. They were finding dozens and dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of vehicles that had been sunk in these levees outside of Houston. And I think it was Houston. I have to double check that. But they said. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, it was Houston. They found like 127 cars out in the bayou, and they used sonar to try to fix it.
Yeah, but the problem was they didn't know if they had enough money to search every one of these vehicles because it would take a huge effort.
Yeah, it's like, they're still raising funding, but they have $40,000 and it wasn't enough.
Isn't that crazy? So, I mean, they're trying to read license plates, but I bet a lot of those are missing because this is clearly insurance-type stuff, but they're wondering. Maybe there would be some bodies in these vehicles. Maybe there would be some contraband. I don't think all of those are going to be cases simply of vehicle theft, just stolen cars.
Yeah,
being
unfortunately
dumped.
Not.
I don't think so. I have a bad feeling they're going to find some really awful stuff there, but
they're
going
to find some bodies,
time
suicides,
will tell.
Homicides, accidents.
You're probably right. Yeah, you're probably right. So I think time will tell on that story, but we'll kind of keep an eye on that one too.
Right. Yeah,
I'm glad you reminded me of that.
Yeah, this is a tame one in comparison.
Okay.
So Mike Spinelli is tracking down these leads and he's learning that some of the names were initially incorrect. For instance, the detective he talks to is actually named Dennis Carroll, but in the Times, he's referred to as Lenny.
Yeah. Which led to, I guess, a career-long nickname for him of Lenny from that
right.
point forward, right? Even though his name was, Denny.
Yeah.
But it was just misrepresented in the newspaper article. And you know how guys around the office are. So, I don't know. To be called Lenny is not terrible, but I guess if it's not your name, it's kind of like, you know what? That's exactly what they did with the Denny's restaurant commercials. Remember?
Oh, what?
Yeah, don't you remember? It was always they were always saying, you know, the real name is Denny's, of course.
Yeah,
you know, Denny's restaurants, mm-hmm. And the joke was that they would call it Lenny's. You remember those little commercials? Yeah, it was just I don't know why that struck me just now, but it did.
It's weird because I realized I'm missing a piece of fundamentally American culture. You know, I was out west recently in California, and what struck me, man, which I didn't realize before, was that there are Burger Kings and Denny's everywhere. Like you can't walk down the street without tripping over a Denny's.
Yeah, and they're a fairly rare sight here. I don't even know if we have them in Georgia now.
I think there are a few.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, well, anyways, there's old commercials where Denny's and Lenny's are mistaken, but that reminded me exactly of this. So
yeah.
Okay, so here's the scoop. So we get this second article from Jalopnik, and it's kind of like, well, it says we solved the mystery, but this is what really happened. Now I find this fascinating because right from the very beginning, there was a white lie told. And the white lie was that when they were unearthing this car back in 1978, an LA Times reporter was kind of poking around, you know, like, what's going on? We know they're unearthing a car back there. What's happening? Mm-hmm. And the police said, well, they did tell them what kind of vehicle, of course, but they, you know, just said, oh, yeah, a couple of kids digging around the backyard found it. And that was what happened. And that's what we told you, right?
Right.
The early part of the podcast.
Initial reports.
That's not what happened at all. Apparently, there was a snitch involved, and the snitch pointed out that house and said, if you dig in the backyard, you're going to find a Ferrari Dino. And so they made up the story just to kind of throw the reporter off track, mm-hmm. Just to kind of give him a little bit of breathing room on the story because they didn't know what was going to happen with it yet. So the snitch took them right to that spot. Where was it? It was in Los Angeles County, but I can't remember exactly where. But they found this car exactly as this guy would describe they would find, and it was, in fact, on the LAPD's stolen list. So the guy said, you know, I know this is part of an insurance scam, mm-hmm. and here's where you're going to find it. So they got away with the insurance scam because the whole thing was paid off, as we said, back in 1978.
So here's the thing. Although Mike is able to track down the retired detective, Dennis Carroll, he reaches out to him in email and says, I'm hunting this down. Carroll initially doesn't want to speak to him at all.
Mm-hmm.
He's retired. He's 74 at the time. And Mike learns that Dennis Carroll doesn't want to talk to him because he believes that this journalist has been in touch with the car's original owner.
Yeah, Cruz. He thinks he's talked to Cruz. And, of course, if Cruz finds out that they're learning all the details about this insurance scam that he pulled back in the 70s, that he's going to be in trouble. He's going to serve jail time for this. So
right.
that's what the investigator was fearful of. And he said, and Mike Spinelli said, no, I've talked to the current owner already. Mm-hmm. I've already pieced that together over the last several months. And so then, of course, you know, the investigator then opens up and says, and that's when he tells him about the snitch and how it wasn't the kids that were involved and all that. So that's all brand new information. And I guess he tells him the real plan as well. Now, the initial plan was that the guys would chop up the Dino, as we said earlier, fence the parts, and then sink the rest somewhere off the coast. And then Cruz was supposed to get a check from the Farmers Insurance Company, just like he did. And then he would give, you know, the guys that did this their cut of the insurance scam money. And then everybody would be happy, you know, a few thousand dollars richer, I guess, in the end, and everything would be fine. And it kind of worked out that way.
What could go wrong?
Except the bad guys, when it came down to time to destroy the vehicle and get rid of the evidence, they found that they couldn't get rid of it. They thought that it was too beautiful or too special of a vehicle to just simply destroy it or, you know, sink it off the coast somewhere as they were told to do. And they tried to hide this thing. They tried to preserve it, as we said earlier, mm-hmm. in a way that they could come back for later, which is crazy. I mean, and they never did. They never came back for it. So it was just left there for all those years, and that snitch knew about it. And I don't know how that happens, but I envision, Ben, that they're sharing a cell. You know, they've done something,
some
petty crime, right?
Yeah,
and they're sharing a cell.
Picture.
Yeah, or maybe they're, you know, like talking to each other with like holding a mirror out of the bars, like looking over in the other cell next to them. And they're talking to the next guy whispering at night, you know, like what had happened.
They're flying a kite.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's possible. Yeah, they're like passing messages between themselves.
You know? What a kite is.
Yeah, exactly. So I've got all these like, you know, very detective book ideas in my head about what's going on, but it's probably a lot less, you know, glamorous than that.
And it could have been.
Not that that's glamorous, but.
Well, it could have also been. The problem is that we're not, probably not going to learn the motives of the snitch.
No, probably never. I mean, we probably won't ever. I'm sure that he was cut some kind of deal in order to give them this information or whatever. Just, you know, the lead kind of is lost.
Oh, that's so weird. Yeah. What if he was arrested for something else and he said, and he used it as a bargaining chip?
Well, that's likely what happened. I mean, I'm thinking that's probably more likely than the scenario that I just played out for you, that, you know, it's a jailhouse whisperer at midnight or something. You know, it's not usually that way, but sometimes it is.
Jailhouse whispers.
Well, you know, they get.
That sounds like the title of something.
Well, I don't know if I want to go down that road
too far. I don't
know
if we should.
Yeah, what kind of literature are you reading?
Oh, gee.
All right, so.
All right, so.
So anyways, that does occasionally happen. You hear about people that talk in jail.
Oh, yeah.
And then they are given some kind of deal in order to rat out the other individual. And that happens often. There's a lot of snitches in jail. So if you're ever there, keep your mouth shut about whatever you've done in the past. That's my advice. All right. So what happens is that, you know, the guys that are supposed to, you know, chop this thing up and destroy it and get rid of the whole thing, all they really did was they cut out that badge that we mentioned before. It was kind of a souvenir. Maybe they said, like, they called it in this Jalopnik article, maybe a claim check. You know, like, they're going to come back for it. This is the matching piece, right?
Oh, yeah.
To prove that it's mine. And they never, ever came back for it. They said it might have been like an old mechanics pit, or I had mentioned that it could have been a dry pool, but I don't think it was, because they never mentioned anything about that in the articles or anything. But they did keep a few details quiet. Mm-hmm. I don't know, just where they were digging it. It was right next to the house, though, so probably not. Just seemed like it was maybe a patch of yard.
Yeah. But,
so when the real story was finally told, you know, this is like May of 2012. So, you know, a few months after the initial article, mm-hmm. just before the last article from Jalopnik, Mike Spinelli went out to Los Angeles to do some interviews with these people, and that's when we get all this this video that's in the YouTube video. It's really kind of they laid it out really well. It's an interesting piece. It's only about 20 minutes long. I think you should definitely watch it. But
sure,
this guy Dennis Carroll, who is now retired and 74, does some pretty good sit down interviews with him, and he was kind of laughing because he almost didn't even remember about this car. You know, when they first asked him about it.
Right. There's a great statistic here, which is at the time that the detectives were working on this, an average of 3,000 cars were stolen in Los Angeles each month.
Yeah, and not only that, this guy says that, you know, I've been on the force for 34 years. I had a 34-year career with the, you know, with LA, and he says, I've seen every single riot in Los Angeles. And he said, you know, there are murders and arsons and robberies and mm-hmm. drug felonies mm-hmm. and everything. He said, a buried car is sort of like, you know, a cat in a tree. It just doesn't mean a whole lot in the grand scheme of things when, you know, I've got all this other stuff going on, some bigger issues.
Right. Unless there is a body or something inside of it.
Yeah. Then it might stick out in his head. But he said, you know, I vaguely remember this story, and I'm sure he, you know, had to research it just a little bit to remember what was going on. But he said, what I do remember about that thing, and this is probably what kept the memory alive for him, was that he said, he got so many phone calls about that vehicle. He said it seemed like everybody and their mother wanted that car. And that's a weird expression, too, by the way. Isn't it usually everybody and their brother wanted that car? He said everybody and their mother wanted that car.
Hmm. They just go everywhere. I you could pull any family relation, though, Scott. You'd be like, everybody and their second cousin wanted that car.
I guess so. It seems to work out that. Anyways, so
here's the big question.
Yeah.
What happened to the car?
Ah, okay. So the real deal is that this is the way it comes from the current owner, and the guy's name is Brad Howard.
Mm-hmm.
And Brad Howard says that Jalopnik got most of the story right, but not everything. There's one crucial thing that was wrong. He said that in 1974, the 246, the 1974 Dino was registered to him almost immediately after it was found. So in 1978, it was registered to him. So it wasn't like owned by this mechanic, and it wasn't lost to time or anything.
Right.
From the get-go, almost, it was owned by Brad Howard, and not exactly right from the beginning, because the way this all pieced together was that, you know, of course, Farmers Insurance sold the car to somebody who bid the high bid. I guess they said between, what, $5,000 and $9,000?
Yes.
And that was a Los Angeles businessman named Ara Manoogian.
Yeah. And
Ara.
Ara Manoogian.
Yeah, Ara.
And so Brad Howard was doing a real estate deal with Ara Manoogian, and while they were in the course of this deal, Howard overheard him talking to this mechanic he had just hired about the Dino, but Howard's spider sense made him think, oh, this guy doesn't actually want this car.
Yeah, they were arguing about it and the condition of the vehicle and, you know, saying like, well, you know, they're talking about the poor condition of the vehicle and how it was difficult to get it started. So he hears all, you know, what's going on, but he's interested because he, you know, he's a young single guy in LA. He's a real estate mogul. He wants to get something going there for himself. He wants to buy this vehicle. He knew about the Dino, great vehicle. I think they stopped making it in 74, I believe. So it was the last year. But he knew he wanted to make an offer for the car, and he did. He said, you know, I'll buy that car from you, but only if you can get it running. And so Manoogian has it at this shop that's owned by a guy, a Ferrari expert, as a matter of fact, named Giuseppe Camp, I'm going to talk with the last name. Giuseppe Capilonga.
Nice.
Maybe.
These people have some great names. So he gets this guy and he says, look, I need you to go all in on this engine. I need you to give it the attention that you can. If it's possible, restore it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it transfers over to Brad Howard, the current owner, as Manoogian had, made the deal with him, I suppose. He honored that deal since it was running. And I guess, Howard had this Ferrari expert, Giuseppe, go through the whole thing. You know, he did the engine work that you mentioned before with, you know, some of the unseen issues, you know, that he handled. So it was running like a top by the end. But he also had him do the full body restoration. I mean, everything, you know, replacing metal where the Dino badge had been, replacing interior components and
dipsticks.
Yeah, all that stuff that had to be replaced. But it's original, you know, factory equipment because you could still get that stuff at that time. He was able to save the wheels. I think he had to buy a set from, you know, three of them from somewhere else or something. There's more information in the video that is not in this article, but he did a complete restoration on this thing, and I'll tell you, it's on the road right now. He almost immediately got the vanity plates that said dug up, as you mentioned earlier in the podcast, Ben, and has had them on there ever since. But a couple of things. It's a beautiful car.
It's a work of art.
It's a spectacular vehicle. I mean, it really is pretty. It's a nice color. It has a beautiful interior. It's spotless. You'd never, ever guess, other than those license plates, this is the car that was buried under someone's backyard for 4 years in Los Angeles.
Yeah, because that is a terrible, terrible thing to do with the car. We've seen repeated instances of someone trying to inter a car and just how quickly nature will take that thing from us. Even if there's a time capsule, remember when we looked at time capsules, it seems like, okay, we'll seal a car in some concrete room. What could go wrong? The answer is everything.
Yeah, there could be a water main leak, which fills the cavern. I don't want to give that story away by any means. There's a lot more to it than that. But here's one good thing for this vehicle. Mm. Around that time, around, 1976, 77, 78 even, there was a drought in Los Angeles. And that helped preserve this car to a level that it wouldn't have been otherwise. You know, if they got their normal amount of rain, this car would have been probably a complete loss. But this car was sort of saved by the drought. Mm-hmm. And, you know, interesting point of reference here, point of time reference, I guess, is that they said that this was right around the time when all the Los Angeles skate crews were, you know, starting to do like their swimming pool skating, you know, because no one had the water to fill their pools. So there were a lot of empty pools all over Los Angeles, all over the West Coast. Mm-hmm. And that's when that whole thing that really took off, when people decided that, you know, that, hey, you know, we're not using this for swimming this summer. Let's do something else with it. And it really led to the whole skateboard culture out in the West Coast. But
the Z-Boys.
Yeah, I'm sure Dogtown and all those guys.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the other thing is that, and you'll learn this by watching the video, is that it escaped about 4 years of Los Angeles smog and pollution that it otherwise would have endured. Now, I know that's funny to say, like, well, yeah, but it's underground and it's still, you know, it's probably far worse underground. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily the case. And the reason that they say that is that apparently when you compare it to other Dinos of the same era, you know, same location, in which there are a bunch of them out there on the West Coast, I guess.
Yeah.
The effects of poor air quality on these vehicles, you know, like places that you can see and places that you can't see. You know, whether it's smog and, you know, whatever's floating around the air. I don't know if it's like acid rain or whatever that hurts the finish. This car is in remarkably good shape for the era that it's from. I know that it got a restoration. I know it got new paint and all that. But
we have no idea how much that all costs.
Yeah, well, that car, the paint that you see on it right now was put on there in 1978. It's in unbelievable shape.
Yeah.
So now the guy keeps it in a garage and undercover, I would guess. So it's rarely subjected to anything, you know, outside of the garage environment, but it does. It makes it to shows and things. But it has been said that, you know, this thing skipped some of the worst years of Los Angeles's, you know, smog pollution problem in the mid to, you know, late 1970s. So there's another benefit. It's strange to think about it that way, but, you know, of course, it's underground and dealing with all the other stuff, you know, the moisture and the bugs and all that. But in some way, it escaped some of the damage, maybe some of the small pocking that happens or something like that.
So what do we learn from this astonishing journey of this car? First, we learn that crime may appear to pay.
Well, Ben, do you want to say that, really?
But
maybe.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
Initial reports will have you believe that crime pays, but the wheels of justice, as is so often said, grind slow but exceedingly fine. And you can tell just by the way that Dennis Carroll was not going to communicate with this guy because the case was still possibly in a state where it could be resolved.
You know what's interesting? We don't really get, in this article at least, we don't really get the complete wrap-up. We don't really know
what happened to Rosendo Cruz.
Yeah, exactly. Did he ever pay for this, or has he passed away? Is he gone? I mean, so that he can't pay for this crime anymore?
Right.
Or is it that, you know, maybe there's a statute of limitations on this thing, or something like that. But they never found the guys that actually that took the car.
Yeah.
They never found who buried the car. It's still kind of an open, interesting case to me. I mean, I'd like to find out more about it. I wonder if there'll ever be a book written about this.
Yeah, one of Cruz's, or somebody claiming to be one of Cruz's children responded in that article, if you check out the comments, and they said, I'm the child of the original purchaser, Rosendo Cruz, and I don't know if they followed up, but, Mike gave them his email address, so I would be very interested to hear what came next with that.
Huh? Yeah, we didn't hear any of that. I didn't read down far enough in the comments to get that. But I wonder what happened. Like they didn't even allude to anything. Like their father's no longer around, or you'll never find him, or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. That's strange. So yeah, I just thought this was a fascinating story, and so did Sean F. apparently, and who wrote in and wanted to hear more about it. And hopefully, listeners will dig a little bit further into this by watching that 20-minute video, because there's more information there, and you get to see it in action. You get to see the car and, you know, the twisty roads out in, you know, the hills of L.A. But pretty fascinating. You get to see the characters involved. You get to hear the engine run. There's a lot of driving shots. It's pretty fascinating. So check it out if you get a chance.
Yeah, and we'll go ahead and post it on our Facebook and Twitter so that you can check it out just by visiting us there. We're CarStuffHSW at both of those. Man, I'm killing it with the smooth segues today, Scott.
I know you are. Nice work.
Thanks. We still have to do another show, though, so we can't go out and search for a buried automotive treasure just yet. You, however, can. And if you have a story about an amazing barn find, or you have a story about another automotive Lazarus, a funny story, by the way, I don't remember if we talked about this on air, but we definitely did off air. So my father has this, for a long time, he had this reputation where he just loved beater cars that were just not that great, and would become very attached to them. And when Kia first started producing the Cephea, he bought one and he drove that thing into the ground. And my mom, no, Mom, I hope I'm not misrepresenting you if you're listening to this, she hated it. And they had a really weird conversation when he said, like, he liked this car so much that when the engine went kaput, he got a refurbished engine, put it in, and changed the car's name to Lazarus.
Oh, my gosh. Not many people would put an engine back in that vehicle, a new engine.
I know. Well, it was refurb.
It's like refilling a Bic lighter. You know? That's what it seems like, doesn't it? You remind me when in this Ferrari story, in the video, the mechanic that eventually went through the whole engine, he referred to Manoogian as, and he was, you know, kind of in broken English, but he said, he is how you say, very economical Manoogian. You know, I thought that was a good way to put it.
That's a euphemism.
He's cheap. Yeah.
And if you want to check out the other shows that we mentioned in the course of this podcast, you can find every single episode of our program at our website, carstuffshow.com. Back to the stories that you have about finding buried cars or cars hidden in barns. This is an exciting thing to us because you never know when something amazing will pop up.
They could find buried audio treasure
at
our website.
Hey, you're doing it.
I don't know.
I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, I'll work on it.
So we want to hear your stories while we're working on our segues and our next episode. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, if you have a tale of astonishing automotive recovery, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us directly. We are
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.